This is a download from the Post Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net.
Welcome. The Marshall Society of Cambridge, the Economic Society of the University of Cambridge, welcomes you to this event, and more particularly, is delighted to welcome Dr. Jesper Jesperson from Roskilde University. He will be speaking about Keynes's general theory in celebration of the forthcoming anniversary. And I think I could leave you in no better hands for this complex but fascinating subject. Right.
Thank you. Yeah, well, first of all, thank you so much for having got this invitation. It's really an honor for me to give this lecture in the Keynes Lecture Room, or Keynes Hall of King's College, the holiest of holiest places, one could say, and not the least by invitation of Marshall Society. As you know, Alfred Marshall, who was in fact the father of the economic tribes here in Cambridge, he was also a mentor to Maynard Keynes, who is, well, in the center of this room and will be a part of my story tonight, because my lecture, that will be about a book, and it is rather rare that a full lecture is given to one single book. But of course, you cannot separate the book from the man and the man from this book, the general theory of employment, interest, and money, which was published the 4th February 36, well, very close to 75 years ago. And my hunch for today is to persuade you that this book is younger than ever. Really, my hunch is to give you an appetite to look more closely into that book, which was, well, very well received and discussed 75 years ago, and ought to be discussed even more today, I should say. And therefore, well, my presentation will rely quite a lot on quotes from the general theory, and that is for many reasons. One reason is to give you this appetite for reading more into the book, but also Keynes was a master of the English language. Well, it's simply a joy, even if you were not an economist. Well, just take an interest into the society, read the book, enjoy the text and the lovely examples of, well, of cleverness and stupidity, which is presented throughout the text. But as I said, well, you cannot separate the author and the book, so therefore I will give a very brief introduction to Maynard Keynes's life. This is of course superfluous for many of you, but perhaps some of the younger don't know the hard facts. And now I will see if this works. It did work. Here we have the young Keynes, born in 1883 in Cambridge. He was really, one could say, a Cambridge baby, a Cambridge student, a Cambridge man, and fellow of this college for all his life, when you add up. And, well, one thing which is worth knowing is that he did not read economics, which I think is a strength, but there are also practical reasons why he didn't have the formal economic study, because it was not yet established when he started up in Cambridge. As I said, he was born in Cambridge, and he became a student at King's College in 1902, just shortly after Queen Victoria has died. So there was a sea change in many respects. educated in math and philosophy, and he followed a number of Alfred Marshall's lectures. And Marshall was at that time really the economist, not only in Cambridge, but I could say, well, to the neoclassical tradition and to the British society at large. I should also say that a lot of my information about Keynes rely upon Robert Skidelsky's wonderful biography. And Robert Skidelsky, those of you who read Financial Times will see that quite often he has an intervention in Financial Times. He's a historian, but he had written the most delightful biography. It's like having dessert all the way through. It's a joy. And anyway, well, a lot of my information I have from this biography, it has just come out in a very short, abbreviated version, a short introduction to Maynard Keynes, published by Oxford University Press. It's only 90 pages, so it's manageable, but also delightful. Anyway, if Keynes had died before the 4th February of 36, well, he would not, say Skidelsky, really have been remembered as an economist. More likely, he would have been remembered, if at all, as the author of The Economic Consequences of the Peace, which was written just shortly after the First World War, where he had, well, been a part of the British delegation to the Versailles conference, setting up the very, very harsh terms to the Germans. And he resigned, and instead he wrote The Economic Consequences of the Peace, where he predicted some of the development which happened to Europe during the interwar period. So, well, perhaps economics is not a predictive science as such, but in the right hands, well, it gives you at least a possibility to see what the future might bring. And that's another gateway also to the general theory. It might give you a recipe of some likely developments in the future. Should say more, he was close to the Bloomsbury Group, which means that he had an intellectual backing group. Names are up there. Well, I'm not a specialist in humanities, but Keynes also became the chairman of the Art of Council for this country. So he had many other abilities. He also, well, was the initiator to the theatre in Cambridge, and he paid a large part of it. And his wife was a ballerina and an actress, so she could perform at the theatre. But anyway, a man with many abilities. And we could just move on and see what is the person. Does it work? Yes, it does work. Here. And here we have Keynes in a more mature age. In the age of the early 50s, where he wrote or started to write the general theory, and well, all of the real social treatises or treatises in social sciences, if you take The Wealth of Nations, if you take Das Kapital, and now the general theory, they're all written of people who were up in their 50s, mature people who know what they were talking about. I think this is at least an observation. I'm a bit disturbed because this is behind my back, but I have it also in front of me. But does the technique work, or doesn't it? If it doesn't, please give me a hint. Keynes, well, he knew that something was wrong in the 30s. Something was wrong with economics and the way economics was presented to the audience. So he had great expectations and wrote to his, I wouldn't say friend, but at least they knew each other quite well, George Bernard Shaw, that I believe myself to be writing a book on economic theory, which will largely revolutionize, not, I suppose, at once, but in the course of the next 10 years, the way the world thinks about economic problems. Well, unfortunately, in this respect, Keynes did not predict correctly. It had a certain impact, but living today, well, we wouldn't say that this book has revolutionized the way we think about economics, at least not the majority or the mainstream within economics. So this discussion is still going on, and in fact, there was a vivid, to some extent, heated debate in the 30s, just after the publication of The General Theory, a debate which one could wish could pop up again, so we could really discuss what is, well, macroeconomics, and how should we investigate, how should we make an analysis of this. And we have up here that he said himself that this book is chiefly addressed to my fellow economists. This is not a popular book. This is not a book about politics in a narrow sense. No, it is about economic theory. And its main purpose is to deal with difficult questions of theory, and macroeconomics is difficult. I myself helped with questions which I myself held with conviction for many years, the theories which I now attack. Really, in some way, one could say that Keynes was, if not an orthodox neoclassical macroeconomist, up to writing the Treatise of Money, well, he had certain conventional, many conventional elements. But if orthodox economics is at fault, the error is to be found not in the superstructure, which has been erected with great care for logical consistency, and we know that, but in a lack of clearness and a generality in the premises, and especially the word generality, well, we should be conscious about taking the title of the book into consideration, and those, and then that is, well, a greeting to his colleagues, those who are strongly wedded to what I shall call the classical theory. All economists before Keynes, he called simply classical economists, will fluctuate, I expect, between a belief that I'm quite wrong and on a belief that I'm saying nothing new. That prediction was pretty good, I should say. But let us see, how he proceeded towards the general theory, because his preface to the book, well, I can recommend strongly. It's only 5 pages. And there he writes that the relationship between this book and my treatise on money, which was kept rather much in the neoclassical way of arguing, is probably clearer to myself than it will be to others. I failed to deal thoroughly with the effect of changes in the level of output, because as long as you are just reasoning within a general equilibrium system, well, at least in the long run, output is given and unchangeable. Why did he put it that way? Because, he started to put a new emphasis on the importance of methodology. Really, it matters the way we look upon reality, and even more important, the way we try to organize our structured thinking of reality. What kind of model do we use? And, well, I have really been persuaded by his radio talk, which he gave in 1934. There was a number. We are in the middle of the crisis of the 30s at that time. And here he put forward really what has changed his mind when he became aware that economists deviate on one very crucial point, the analytical framework. And well, he's speaking up on these two quotes about a gulf separating the analytical macroeconomists. There are those who choose the general equilibrium system and say that if we have a well-functioning market system, it will sooner or later arrive at the general equilibrium. As well, probably if we are all economists here, then we know that this is the main content, or one of the main contents and conclusions thereby within general equilibrium theory. And then on the other side of the gulf are those who reject that framework, to put it briefly. And why so? Because if the economic system is not self-adjusting, if it is not self-adjusting, what then? And he said that this gulf between these two schools of thought is deeper, I believe, than most of those on either side of it are aware of. And I could repeat that with relevance for today, really. On which side does the essential truth lie? That is the vital question to us to solve, and still is. And therefore, well, it is a very refreshing book. In fact, this is from the radio talk, but they have just been issued by Macmillan. All Keynes's radio talks has been collected just into one volume, and they are also an easy read because they have been written to be taught or just read. So here is a good source. Well, my abbreviated understanding what Keynes is saying is be realistic. And I hope that's up there, yes. Because a self-adjusting economic system is, however, pure assumption. There is no theoretical reason for believing it to be true. A very moderate amount of observation of the facts, unclouded by preconceptions, is sufficient to show that they do not bear it out. It's Keynes's words, not mine. And then he goes on, and we see how it goes on, still in 45, but he's very much on track for the general theory. Now I range myself with the heretics. There is, I am convinced, a fatal flaw in that part of the orthodox reasoning which deals with the theory of what determines the level of effective demand and the volume of aggregate employment and, one could say, output. So here we see that he is under his way to set up a theoretical or methodological framework to understand effective demand and the importance of effective demand, because until then, well, supply did create its own demand. So a general theory is what he wants to present, and I have emphasized general because he goes on. And now we are in the general theory. I shall argue that the postulates of the classical theory are only applicable to a special case and not to the general case. And as we know from, the theory of science, the more general a theory is, the more, well, convincing it is, and it overrules a more specific case. And moreover, the characteristics of that special case assumed by the classical theory happen not to be those of the economic society in which we actually live. Please recall the heading of my former slide, be realistic. Look out of the window, see what's going on, and then, well, try to see if it fits to the model which you use to understand that reality. And if not, well, the result is that the teaching is misleading and disastrous if we attempt to apply it to the facts of experience. Wow. But, well, I'm just quoting Keynes, so I feel myself at least taking into consideration that it is the general theory we're talking about, a rather significant quote from that book, that if the model does not mirror reality, well, it could have disastrous consequences. So how could we be more specific about the content, not just bashing the colleagues here in Cambridge? Here we have we have macroeconomics implications of microeconomic uncertainty and uncertain expectations. That's what really Keynes seems to focus on to explain why we need a new framework, analytical framework. And we talk also today quite a lot about the micro foundation of macroeconomics. But that micro foundation which we use today does not contain uncertainty. Uncertainty is not a part of that micro foundation of the general macroeconomic model. But the problem is that there are no prefixed rules of what it means to behave rationally when uncertainty prevails. That, of course, explains why it is difficult to put uncertainty into a model which assumes rationality. But it's important also to emphasize that Keynes did also assume that people behave rational. But the problem is, what does it mean to be rational if you don't have full information? If you know that something is missing, what's then rational? And that then we move into philosophy and philosophy via behavior of probability. And Keynes had, as some of you know, had written a treatise on probability. So he knew what this is about. When you lack information, what does it mean to be rational? So Keynes' theory is not a theory about irrational behavior. Quite the reverse. What does it mean to be rational when you know you don't know? It's partly a philosophical problem. Uncertainty or state of confidence, as it is also quite often called, well, is situated. It varies from case to case. No clockwork system can capture uncertainty. Partly because we don't know, but also because we might know that it changed through time. So uncertainty makes aggregate macro behavior different from what I call N times the ideal micro behavior. And by micro behavior, I mean the way we are taught microeconomics in conventional neoclassical microeconomics, which is absolutely useful where it is applicable. Absolutely. Where uncertainty does not prevail, then, well, I think that we couldn't make a proper analysis without also the neoclassical micro foundation, but only when it is applicable to reality. And I have listed a number of situations where it is rational for households and firms to act dependently, to watch each other and see what the neighbor is doing, because they might have some of the information which I'm missing, and so on. Or you just follow convention. Convention is, well, the accumulated knowledge, accumulation of habits, which have given good results through centuries. So conventions might be useful. Or in intuition. Some have a stronger intuition than others, and those with a strong intuition might, well, follow that and react more quickly, as we know from the financial markets, on new information. And that's sometimes just condensed into the catchword of animal spirit, which could easily be given a negative connotation. But animal spirit, well, that's... In some way, well, if you dare to rely on your intuition, then it is, and have good results, then it is rational. Sure. So that's a part of the Keynes' microeconomic foundation, and we should also learn from the past, because we don't know with certainty the future. That's the only certain thing. We don't know the future. And hence, and therefore, in reality, there is no such thing as rational expectation, meaning perfect foresight. There is, well, no individual representative micro agent behind the macro behavior, and finally, the general market clearing assumption established through perfect competition and flexible wages and prices, well, is not a part of reality, because it cannot take place as a general phenomenon. Well, so this is halfway through I wanted to say, that Keynes's micro foundation, because there is a micro foundation, is very different, or rather different, from what we are used to call micro foundation, and it has to be put into an analytical framework where uncertainty is a part of the story. So having gone that far, I think it's time to reread and reflect on what's in the general theory. And I have used a quote from Skidelsky, his biography, which I've already mentioned, that he sums it up this way, that Keynes's perception was that economists did not behave in the way economists said they did, that something vital had been left out of their accounts, and it was this missing element which explained their malfunctioning, the malfunctioning of the economies, because we did not really integrate uncertainty, although it is difficult. Keynes accused economists of his day of abstracting from the existence of uncertainty. So, well, I'm just echoing Skidelsky and many other scholars, Keynes scholars. This stressing uncertainty is not new, but really to say that this made the general equilibrium analytical framework redundant in some way, or not applicable. That's at least a part of my contribution. In practice, that means that taking uncertainty seriously, well, then we might prevent making a so-called fallacy of composition or a fallacy of equilibrium, assuming that the micro behavior, if we sum it up, could mirror the macro behavior, assuming that one market in equilibrium, if that's disturbed, it has no implication for the other markets. So with regard to the so-called fallacy of composition, or the atomic failure. Well, Keynes said himself that though an individual whose transactions are small in relation to the market can safely neglect the fact that demand is not a one-sided transaction, it makes nonsense to neglect it when we come to aggregate demand, to the sum of the individuals. This is the vital difference between the theory of the economic behavior of the aggregate and the theory of the behavior of the individual. So therefore, please separate between microeconomics and macroeconomics. And, well, I just try to give you one example of how frequently we meet this fallacy of composition. And, well, this is for sure not the best diagram I have made in my life, but we had to learn, all of us. But this is the conventional presentation of the labor market with a demand and supply curve. And why is it presented this way so frequently in mainstream economic literature and also in the literature which was in front of Keynes 75 years ago? Well, many of you have probably read Mankiw's textbook, the textbook called Macroeconomics. Yes, well, I can hardly imagine a student of these days who have not, or he or she has not been in touch with Mankiw's textbook on macroeconomics. And have some of you have been puzzled? What is the first analytical model which you met in this textbook? Oh, well, this is not an exam, but anyway. supply and demand, yes. In the pizza market. So the very first model is a microeconomic description of what's going on in the pizza market, which I think is a rather fair presentation from a microeconomic point of view. What's going on there? We have, as you said, demand and supply, which Marshall had learned us, and we know from Marshall and other eminent scholars, I should say. But then, well, there is this jump from micro to macro, because if a pizza market is a useful analytical framework for pizza, why shouldn't it be for other markets? And quite quickly, well, we move into a macro section of the book where we find this labor market. Now it is not pizza, now it's labor. And, well, it might be true that there is very little repercussion from the pizza market to the macroeconomic system. But trust me, there are repercussions from the labor market and changes in the labor market to the rest of the economy for many reasons, and that is a part of, well, macroeconomics. So therefore, well, what I have quoted here, and unfortunately, well, it is a quote not from Mankiw, because it's even more precisely written in the Beck textbook, but it is on the same rail, and well, it's now written so, but it's easier for you to read than for me. But otherwise, well, what did the Beck say? Keynesian or demand deficient unemployment arises when wages have not yet adjusted to restore labor market equilibrium. Involuntary unemployment will slowly bid wages down, moving the economy from A, that is the pink arrow, down to E, leaving the rest of the economy untouched. It could be a pizza market, it could be a labor market, it doesn't matter, because ceteris is paribus, or ceteris, as you say, is paribus, and there is no disturbances or derived effects. And that is, well, what I call a fallacy of composition. Why so? Because it's true that for the individual, if I lower my wage claim, I get your job. But does that create more jobs in the economy? Well, we cannot take it for granted. And the other fallacy, the fallacy of, assuming all other markets in equilibrium, so you can just make the adjustment here, is another example that which goes up against Keynes's proposed method. So what could be said about the fallacy of composition is that it is based, and you run the risk of committing the fallacy of composition if you base your macroeconomic theory on individual experiment. And in this case, well, because what is the business reaction to falling wages? Well, if you have marginal cost pricing, you know what it is. And even if the market is moving towards equilibrium, then, well, what happens to the other markets? To what extent are they disturbed? And the future is unknown, so you cannot take for granted that the actors or agents know where we will end up at the end of the day. That's in fact Keynes's one of Keynes's major argument that we simply don't know. So this is another implication of the importance of choosing one's analytical framework with great care. Does it mirror the real world? And that had made me, well, conclude this section that it is important to get the methodology right. And I try to urge my students when they write their dissertation, start out, well, describe what part of reality do you want to make an analysis of, and how do you set up a relevant model for that purpose. And that is also the way Keynes sum this part of the argument up, that economics is a science of thinking in terms of models. We cannot make economics without models. For sure not. But it is joined to the art of choosing the relevant model, as he said. And, well, be careful, because unlike the typical natural science, the material of social science to which it is applied is, in too many respects, not homogeneous, because society changes, people learn, and uncertainty is changing, as I have just been around. So this analytical framework is, and the insistence on choosing the right analytical framework, I think, is the red thread, or one of the red threads throughout the general theory. And that leads me to, well, the main theoretical novelty of the general theory, because up to now we have talked more about, well, methodology and analytical framework. So what is the theoretical novelty? And that is the principle of effective demand. And you see, well, we get it up there. If, well, one is asked, what do you relate to the name of Keynes? Well, of course, when I ask an economist, then, well, the immediate answer is demand. And some would say effective demand. And in some way, this is unfortunate that this mirror has been conveyed, that Keynes is the demand man, if you like. That Keynes only focused on demand, because that's not true. But, of course, when he himself is partly guilty of doing that, because he said, well, my invention My new theory is about effective demand. And he was wondering how effective demand or how demand could have been squeezed out of conventional macroeconomics, you know, and the character, the caricature of classical macroeconomics is that supply creates its own demand. That is a caricature as well. As it is to say that demand creates its own supply, and that's the essence of Keynes. No, it is not. It's just a plea. If we live in an uncertain world, how could we abstain from taking demand into consideration? Because we are more often than not outside equilibrium, where we know that many forces are at play at the same time. And effective demand is a very rich theory. And only for that sake, well, I can strongly recommend a reread or a read of this general theory, because the way it is presented is typical for the day of Keynes and the 30s. Here, have we the effective demand set up in a figure? And within his days, well, it was the expectations of businessmen who was the driving force, according to Keynes, of the market economy. And what was driving the businessmen? That was the expectation of demand that they were able to sell their goods. And that is, well, what is written here, but seldomly referred to in textbook, that it is the expected proceeds from aggregate demand, what you are able to sell. But equally important, that this, well, this production and this sale to consumers and investors have to be profitable. No reasonable, no rational businessman would produce if he expects himself to lose money on the production. So therefore, well, and that comes, at least from my reading, clearly out of the general theory, that, well, there are at least two legs behind the principle of effective demand. One is expected aggregate demand by businessmen, and the other is the requirement of profitability. That if the production is not profitable, then, well, you could, as a consumer, come and ask, well, can I buy? But if you don't offer a price which is profitable, you won't get any good. So therefore, the theory of effective demand is for sure a two-legged theory. But then, well, and this is not directly in the general theory. You might find some indication of the importance of the financial sector and the sources for the importance of the financial sector in Keynes's writing is either going back to a treatise on money, which is very elaborate on the functioning of the financial sector, but still within the general equilibrium system. But the functioning of the financial sector is very rich in a treatise on money. And you will also find some indication if you take his summing up article from 37, which is just called The General Theory of Employment, funnily enough, where he also indicate that businessmen, even if they have a fair expectation of being able to sell the goods, even if they expect to get profit, if they cannot get finance, if the bank doesn't trust them and won't give the initial finance so they can start up production before they get proceeds, before they get profits, well, then they're stuck. And I think the application to the actual situation is straightforward, that difficulties within the financial sector might create further difficulties for the productive sector, which might harm output as a whole, which is determined by effective demand. And you could make this concept even more elaborate, or even more concept of effective demand even more broadly ranging by saying that, well, it is not only the supply of finance or the availability of finance which is a necessity for business to produce, but also, of course, availability of other factors of production. Take the discussion about the labour market. We have just seen the labour market, but the labour market, it's much more complicated, and there's a lot of talk about labour market reforms, labour market institutions, how wages are negotiated, the power structure between trade unions and employers' unions, and all these things have an impact on how, and education, research has an impact on the supply of factors of production, and still without availability of factors of production, output as a whole is influenced. So, one can put many things into this theory or principle of effective demand, and this is really what makes me think that the book is so relevant for today, because you can add financial crisis, you can add labour market institution, labour market reform, and shortly you can add environmental issues, the lack of availability of energy, imagine that, or the lack of availability of water, imagine that. That will have an impact on output as a whole, and therefore on effective demand, which is not demand, in the narrow-minded sense which is so often applied to Keynes. No, effective demand means, at the end of the day, what determines output as a whole determined by the business sector. And you could add a fifth leg, economic policy. Of course, economic policy penetrates a number of the other squares up there. But take the actual situation. How does the actual economic policy influence output as a whole through different macroeconomic channels? We have just had figures for the fourth quarter of this country, which was a surprise for many, but perhaps not for all. But, as you know, economics is not a predictive science. Let me make a summing up on this issue of effective demand, because, as I said, I'm not for sure not the only one who had elaborated on Keynes's use of that concept, and I have a quote from a very interesting book, The General Theory of Profit Equilibrium, written by Fanning and O'Mahony back in year 2000, where they, this is not from the conclusion, but anyway, where they put forward this observation that essentially what Keynes did in the general theory was to devise a method of addressing the question he posed by extending the supply side / demand side analysis of the Marshallian, and we are the Marshall Society, so how could it be even better, tradition from commodities and factors of production to output as a whole, and I, would like to add credit, supply of energy, environment, labour, and these, which is normally considered as growth factors. So here we are, and I'm approaching the end of my lecture, but I have still something to say, perhaps especially with more specific relevance for today. And that I will do by quoting Keynes once again. You could say, and sorry for that, but I think it is a delight to be able to quote him and to put it forward to you. And that this quote is the beginning of his final chapter, where he just sums up some of the social conclusions which could be derived from his general theory. And there he states that the outstanding faults of the economic society in which we live are its failure to provide for full employment. And, well, I have lived through a period of 30 years with high unemployment in Europe. And in your country, well, it's wavering more, but you have had pretty high unemployment, at least. Its failure to provide for full employment and its arbitrary and inequitable distribution of wealth and income, which also go very up, very much up against neoclassical theory, because there you are have an income which is settled by the marginal productivity. Here, he said, it's arbitrarily fixed. The bearing of the foregoing on the first of these is obvious. Yeah, I wish it were. But there are also two important respects in which it is relevant to the second, that distribution is not determined by the economic system, but by politics. So, I have a few more comments, which I think the latter is very relevant for today, but also there are other observations which is even more relevant for today, I think, because we have just seen that in a highly specialized market economic system, uncertainty prevails. This is even truer when the markets are extended worldwide through the process of globalization. The larger the market, the more uncertainty. In that case, it is an illusion to imagine the market forces by themselves can create its own demand. But don't fall into the trap and think that demand can create its own supply. No, it is really a mixed game. If one gives up the analytical precondition of assuming that the underlying framework is a stable general equilibrium system, then it becomes obvious by logic that we do not know what the future will bring, which is a part of uncertainty. This is true for the individual and for government, unfortunately. But, and that is, according to my mind, an important but, the individual has no power to change this overall situation. In fact, following the argument of the fallacy of composition, there is a risk that the rational response of many individuals undertaking at the same time might aggravate the macroeconomic imbalances, which is known as, well, the paradox of savings or the paradox of wages, which I have just demonstrated. Governments, on the other hand, do still, in most countries, have the power to influence effective demand significantly for good, and would probably some of you more skeptical liberals say for bad, but they have the power to influence effective demand for good and for bad. This implies that the general theory is not only relevant for understanding a depression economy. Take, for example, the Chinese government. That could also benefit from reading the general theory in its attempt to control the rampant growth rates. Anyway, Keynes did not put forward in his concluding chapters, or he did put forward one more political controversial conclusion, that the outcome of an unregulated market process may cause arbitrarily an inequitable distribution of wealth and income. Existing inequalities are not helpful in creating the saving needed for real investment. To the contrary, Keynes demonstrated that saving is an automatic outcome from undertaking real investment, either by the private sector or by the public sector. Hence, wealth inequalities could be reduced without doing any harm to real investment. In fact, increased financial savings is likely to reduce effective demand and make real resources even more underutilized, especially in cases with abundant supply of labor. Increased tax rates could make society fairer without obstructing the growth process. Do I have to say it's come close to the actual situation? But, and this is the final sentences, so, well, cheer up in some way. Keynes did not take a definite stand on what government should do, because this was a treaty to his fellow economists, and between 8 in the morning and 4 o'clock in the afternoon, in my country, we are theorists. And then after 4 o'clock, sorry, it's after 4 o'clock. But anyway, off duty, you might become politicians. But between 8 and 4, we try to be as objective, as theoretical as possible. So there is rather little in the general theory on specific policy recommendations. If anything, Keynes expressed a preference for monetary policy rather than for fiscal policy. He considers himself all the way through primarily, as I said, as a theorist, especially when he addressed his fellow economists, and that he did this way by saying when he was retiring from his editorship at the Economic Journal in 45, "Economists, ladies and gentlemen, are the trustees not of civilization, but of the possibilities of civilization." And by that, I will say thank you for your attendance.